It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about how unlimited vacation could make you more productive. All right, I'm out of here.
I think you better stick around for a couple more hours.
A little bit longer.
Yeah, a little bit longer. Before that, though, we're going to be talking about the comments Pope Francis made earlier today about gay Catholics.
On the Pope's flight back from Rome to Rome from Brazil, he said he would not judge gay Catholics, including priests, as long as they have goodwill and search for the Lord, he said. Well, here to break down these comments for us and what they may mean for Catholics around the world is Wayne Thompson. He is Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at Carthage College in Kenosha. Wayne, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the media certainly reacted to these comments. This was all over the news. How big a deal are they really, do you think?
Well, in terms of a shift in rhetoric, they might, indicate some real change coming from the Vatican and for the Roman Catholic Church. But in terms of institutional policies, probably I would not look for a lot of change there.
Right. This is just the Pope talking to reporters on a plane, not an official encyclical or a papal bull or anything with that sort of standing, right?
Well, no, but when the Pope speaks, people listen, and the Catholic hierarchy is very media savvy, and so comments made on a plane, although, you know, informal and lacking the authority of an encyclical or a pastoral letter might come from the bishops and so on, it still carries a lot of weight. I mean, obviously, you can see the blogosphere has lit up here now.
Now, these comments might be in line with what's going on here in the United States, a lot of trend toward acceptance of lesbians, gays here in the U.S., the Defense of Marriage Act, overturn of the Supreme Court, so on. But is this directed toward the rest of the world as much as it is us here in the U.S.?
Well, Possibly not. That's a good point. The African Catholics in Africa, certainly the hierarchy there, the bishops and cardinals, probably also in Asia, may be less the audience for this kind of comment. It's North American and European Catholics that may be a little bit more the target audience for these comments.
Why is that?
Well, because in the general cultural climate does have an impact on the church, as much as the church on paper is a top-down decision-making apparatus or bureaucracy, the cultural climate does have an impact. And the cultural climate for sexuality issues, particularly those related to homosexuality, has been shifting considerably in North America and Europe toward greater tolerance. And that's that shift has occurred among Catholics at an even greater rate than for other parts of the population. I looked at a Pew survey from 2013 that said 71% of Catholics think homosexuality should be accepted. This is among American adults, compared to 65% of mainline Protestants. By comparison, among white evangelical Protestants, 59% think homosexuality should be discouraged. So there are cultural changes in the United States among Catholics that are favorable toward greater tolerance toward homosexuality.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, there's a kind of a tension in the Catholic Church. I mean, it's inherently, in a way, a conservative institution built to maintain timeless values regardless of the vagaries of public opinion. And yet, there's probably a sense that they don't want to be seen as completely out of touch with their parishioners, at least in certain countries. How do they resolve that?
Well, the Catholic Church through the ages has had a kind of organizational savvy or even genius for changing just enough at the right times. I'm thinking here about Vatican II that occurred in the 1960s into the 1970s, where the church engaged in, the Italian word is aggiornamento, which really means an updating of the church. Vatican II is a good example of that kind of incremental change where the church changes just a little bit at the right times. It is inherently a conservative institution, religion is in general, because they base authority in an earlier era. So that's to be expected. But there still is updating that goes on. And I think that the comments of Pope Francis indicating a greater empathy toward homosexual identity among priests and for Catholic laity who maybe LGBTQ persons, that should be viewed in that light. There is a history of the Catholic Church updating just enough at the to keep up with the times, if you will.
But not everyone was happy at the time with Vatican II, thinking it went too far. And with announcements like this from the Pope, is there a risk of alienating maybe more conservative members of the Church, whether here or in places like Africa and Latin America?
Well, it's true. That yes, in certain parts of the, you know, if you view Catholicism as a global religion, yes, that's true. Here in North America, though, these comments are probably going to be mostly well-received, although there is this distinction between traditionalist Catholics and what some people call cafeteria-style Catholics, or those that are more accommodating, more accepting of cultural relativism. But keep in mind, the Pew Forum poll shows 71% of Catholics believe, and this is a 2013 poll, that that our society should be more accepting of homosexuality. That is a sea change that's gone on in our culture over the last, especially over the last decade. Catholics aren't immune from that. The Pope's well aware of that when he made those comments.
You mentioned earlier that this really lit up the blogosphere among Catholics and the media in general. One of the themes, the threads I've been seeing is, hey, this is yet another example of Pope Francis reaching out to marginalized groups. Do you think that's a trend in his papacy so far?
Well, yes, it is. And you have to understand that Roman Catholic hierarchy is trying to get off of the sexuality issues, and so that they can get more attention to the kinds of issues that the Catholic bishops are pushing, which would include a preferential option for the poor. The selection of Pope Francis as Pope has to be viewed in that light as well. So if they're going to get a louder megaphone, if you will, in for the Church, then they have to get the subject off the sexuality issues. Now, so you could say that this does not move them in that direction, but in a way it does, because it once they've indicated greater tolerance, they can tie it into the theme of preferential option for the poor and other kinds of issues, talking to marginalized groups. So I think that Pope Francis has struck a theme of greater tolerance and understanding of marginalized groups.
Before I let you go, I wanted to talk to you about the style of the new Pope. We just saw him out from behind bodyguards and bulletproof glass and in crowds in Rio. He's just kind of shooting the breeze with reporters for 80 minutes on a plane. This is a different kind of Pope than we're used to, isn't it?
And perhaps different than what was expected when he was selected. The Vatican's a bit of a black box in terms of finding out what the inner discourse in the inner sanctum is, but the selection of Pope Francis was expected to be a placemaker. That is not a celebrity pope. He may be breaking out of that mold under the force of his own personality and because of that contact and comfort with the masses.
Wayne, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Carthage College in Kenosha.
Coming up next, we'll talk about how unlimited vacation could do more than just be a lot of fun. It could boost your productivity. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, we're in the middle of a lovely Wisconsin summer, and lots of us are probably pining to get out of the office and take advantage of the weather.
It is hard, though. We've got a limited number of vacation days. We all might be trying to bank them for when we really need the time off.
Well, a recent trend in the workplace is to give employees unlimited vacation. And here to talk with us about that is Lydia Dishman, a business journalist and regular contributor to Fast Company. Lydia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So for a lot of us, the phrase unlimited vacation does not compute. What does that mean?
Oh, that's basically just tossing the two-week standard policy that a lot of companies use in favor of just giving people the freedom to choose their own length of vacation.
So the sky's the limit. I could take off 3 months if I got my job done?
essentially, yes, but a lot of companies are finding that people stick pretty closely to that 2 or 3 week limit anyway.
So it sounds kind of like employee heaven. How does it seem to go over when companies start doing it?
Well, it varies, but as I said, a lot of companies are finding that when they toss out the two-week standard, that a lot of people are sticking close to it. Even in such industries as healthcare, you might not think that that would be something that would stray too far from that norm, but a company called Audax Health tossed out that standard and then conducted a survey with their employees and found that 95% of the 100 employees were very satisfied with unlimited vacation. No surprise there. They also get unlimited sick days. So while they have no hard data, Audax Health has found on average that most of their employees take between 2 and 3 week vacations.
So is unlimited vacation and in some cases unlimited sick time, is this being implemented in places where people, the culture is to work till you drop pretty much, and this is a way of kind of easing the tension?
Well, there is definitely some of that in startups where people do tend to work round the clock, especially engineers that are getting ready to deliver new products. Dharmesh Shah, who's the co-founder of HubSpot, said he doesn't track vacations, but he definitely does find himself working late at night. Laura Fitton, who actually started HubSpot, she says that the last time she took a vacation day was when her child was sick, so it was hardly a day at the beach.
Well, a study you looked at showed that something like, I think it was 12% of participants feel guilty that they're not at work when they're on vacation. Does something like unlimited vacation take care of the guilt? You sort of feel like, well, I guess it's okay.
Part of that is true. Some people do feel like, you know, they can completely unplug, but other people find that they need to continue checking in. One of the women that I interviewed, Sharon Rosenblatt, said that while she was on vacation, she found herself writing part of a federal proposal response while she was stuck in traffic because the client extended service into her vacation time.
Wow. Well, can you tell me something about the places where this is being implemented? I guess give me a sense of how widespread it is so far.
Well, it's, as I said, a lot of different types of companies from, you know, anywhere from healthcare, large healthcare companies to startups. I have one anecdote from Braintree, which is a global payment platform that has clients such as Airbnb and Living Social and OpenTable. And they say that not having a policy works really well, that, you know, they treat everybody like adults, and they use Parkinson's Law as much as possible. And if you're not familiar with that, it's basically the amount of time which one has to perform a task is the amount of time it will take to complete that task. So They try to be as efficient as possible. But Braintree, is just one example of a different type of company that's using the no vacation policy. Another is Motley Fool, which is a 17-year-old company, and they actually send people on vacation when they feel like they need it. They send them on a two-week, what they call a fool's errand, and, force them out the door and tell them not to come back until 2 weeks is up.
That sounds okay. Now, are all these companies in the Bay Area? Does anyone in Wisconsin, for instance, or the Midwest do this?
Well, I don't know about Wisconsin, but I know that, these companies are not all in the Bay Area, definitely. Motley Fool is based just outside of Washington, D.C., so you definitely have people, you know, across the country that are tapping into this plan.
So in terms of productivity, what are employers seeing when they implement unlimited vacation?
Well, I think an honor system really does speak to the best of people. I think when they feel like they are responsible for their own work and that somebody isn't looking over their shoulder and they're not clocking in and out, that they actually will do the right thing and, you know, get their work done on time, in some cases even earlier.
So it has a potential, and we're seeing that it does boost productivity.
Absolutely.
So there's a good reason for doing it. What are reasons do you think that some companies aren't doing it?
Well, I think that probably, you know, companies that have had that standard policy in effect for, you know, decades might not want to step outside of the box and, you know, allow a lot of people to just take unlimited time off. I think that, larger companies, especially, you know, when you get up to 1,000-plus employees, it's a little difficult to keep tabs on everybody. But, you know, I think it definitely can work for a lot of different types of companies if you have a decent system in place to communicate exactly what's expected when people are taking vacation. You can't just, you know, say one day, hey, I'm taking off, and, you know, then pull the plug and come back 2 weeks later. I think it's, you know, communicating is really important before you go.
In terms of how people relate to one another inside an office environment, inside a workplace, does having unlimited vacation, do you think, change the dynamic at all?
I think that it definitely could. I think it will encourage people to really think about their own role and how that affects other people that they work with, either directly or indirectly. I think that, as I said before, communicating is really important. So if you're planning to take a two-week solid vacation and completely unplug, it is really important to communicate that well beforehand and let everybody know what you're working on so that everyone can work around you while you're not there.
And if one person, say, were to really run with the idea of unlimited vacation and say, I'm going to take a month in Hawaii, whereas Bob in the cubicle next door says, well, for me, you know, unlimited means 2 or 3 weeks, you know, there could be a sort of tensions there, I can imagine. I suppose people kind of have to be on the same page about what unlimited vacation means.
Yes, and I think that that's where, you know, managers can sit down with their staff and communicate exactly what is expected. You know, a month off might be perfectly fine if you've, say, just delivered a new product or service, or you've reached a major deadline. Then it's time to exhale and regroup and tap into your creative and innovative channels again. So that might be exactly perfect. While you're in the middle of some major project, though, that might not be such a good time. But I think the important thing is for everyone to sit down and talk about what their goals are and realistically talk about what they're looking at when they do choose to take time away from the office.
Do you think this is part of an effort to redesign office culture?
I certainly think so, and I think it's kind of an extension of telecommuting. You know, when more and more people started telecommuting and you don't have a boss trolling the halls or looking over your shoulder while you're sitting in your cubicle, it does give people a certain amount of responsibility that they have to place on themselves to get that work done, not necessarily between the hours of 9 to 5. So I think that the unlimited vacation is just sort of a natural outgrowth of that phenomenon where, you know, people are taking more and more responsibility for what they deliver, as it should be. And, you know, it doesn't really matter if they, you know, spend an hour in the morning looking at a beautiful sunrise as long as they are, you know, meeting their deadline by, say, 3 o'clock, if that's what's called for.
Well, you may have seen this piece. Last year, Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote a pretty widely read Atlanta column saying that women really can't have it all unless they have the ability to make their own schedules. Do you see this as a step in that direction at all?
Yes, I think it is definitely a step in that direction. But, you know, when I interviewed Laura Fitton, as she said, she took a vacation day just to deal with a sick child. So we definitely, as women, are playing a juggling act, especially if we have children at home and, you know, are the primary caregiver. But I think that, you know, again, the responsibility that you place on yourself trumps everything. And so, you know, it's up to you to strike that balance of, you know, your time off and your time in the office or spent working wherever that office might be.
Now, you probably talked to some folks and got a sense of how it was going over there. And we've got about a minute left, but do you think this is something that's going to stick around and catch on and spread?
Absolutely. I think that the people that have implemented it have had a great deal of success, and certainly, you know, the more that people understand that it can be done and that, you know, people aren't just, you know, stepping away and, you know, going packing their suitcase and never coming back is really not a reality. That, you know, people do have to work and they will come back, but they are very appreciative of the fact that a company trusts them enough, their manager or their supervisor trusts them enough to go off and then come back recharged and ready to face new challenges.
All right. Well, Lydia, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Lydia Dishman, business journalist and regular contributor to Fast Company.
So what do you think about this unlimited vacation idea? Is it something you'd like to see at your workplace? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Or if you own a business, is this something you would consider doing? An honor system unlimited vacation? Central Time Facebook page. Love to see what you think.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll check out the Experimental Aviation Association's annual Air Venture. It's coming up in Oshkosh this week.
Then we'll discuss a new Frontline report about the state of for-profit assisted living homes.
And we'll hear about more extroversion and how it might make you happier.
That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 4, we'll look at a new study on poverty in the United States, showing that a growing number of us are on the brink of poverty at some point in our lives.
Now we'll look at the risk of terrorism and how we respond to that risk. Our guest is a security expert who says we may overreact to unlikely events.
And we want to hear from you during this conversation. Do you think our federal response to terrorism has been an overreaction? Or do you think the risk of a major terrorist attack justifies most of our homeland security efforts? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
Our guest is Bruce Schneier. He's a security technologist, author of a lot of books, including Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust Society Needs to Survive. And we've linked to his blog at the Central Time Facebook page. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot has happened. We found out a lot from Edward Snowden about what our government was doing. But I want to go back a little before that. You wrote a piece that appeared on CNN talking about how there's a built-in incentive for policymakers to react on the side of extreme caution, maybe overreact to terrorism. Can you tell that story?
Well, I mean, I had a lot of different examples. But if you think of a politician after a terrorist attack, right, I think of two of them. On one hand, one says, we're all in danger, we're all going to die unless you do this laundry list of things. On the other hand is me saying, oh, don't worry about it, this almost never happens, just get on with your life and we're not going to change anything. Fast forward 5 years, if nothing happens, he takes credit for it.
All that effort we put in prevented an attack. Yay.
And it's interesting. I remember then Attorney General John Ashcroft speaking in 2003. I live in Minneapolis, and he was here. And he said that. He said it's been 2 years since 9/11. There have been no more terrorist attacks. He forgot about the anthrax attacks. But he said that's proof our policies are working. And I'm listening, and I thought, well, there were no attacks in 2 years before 9/11. You didn't have any policies. What does that prove? But in any case, The overreaction, right, will get credit. If, fast forward 5 years, I'm wrong, my career is over. Right? If you underreact, the downside of being wrong is so much greater. You have to go against the police. It is powerful to look tough on crime, on terrorism. When people are scared, they want a strong leader. All of these roll into this tendency, not based on politics, on both sides of the U.S. aisle, to overreact to the threats. You want to be seen as doing something, right? Something must be done. We are doing something. Even if doing nothing is better, there's a bias towards action, towards doing something.
Well,
so there's a bias towards action. There's a bias towards overreaction. There's a bias towards exaggeration. Because the people who do that get more resonance. I remember Bill Clinton, after he was president, speaking at some Democratic Leadership Council, and he said, I remember this quote, when people are scared, they'd rather have someone who is strong and wrong than correct and right.
Well, the tricky part there, it seems like, is trying to find out where a reasonable reaction ends and an overreaction begins. Don't we, I mean, after we see something like 9/11, and isn't it logical, isn't it rational to try to do something to prevent that happening again?
It's emotional. It's normal. It's not rational, right? Because the question is, how likely is it? I don't know if you remember, we were hearing that we have a terrorist attack every month, the world has changed. I mean, all of these ridiculous assessments of the future, we would hear them, and they just made no sense. But we were all scared, and of course, we don't want this to ever happen again. It turns out that attack is singular, is so rare, that terrorism almost never happens. Terrorism on that scale never happens except for once, and we have overreacted. Now, it is normal. I mean, rational, looking at the risks, looking at the costs. You know, the government doesn't do cost-benefit analyses on these measures, but there are some researchers who do. There are things we're doing that make financial sense if they prevent a 9/11 every month, which is just absurd. But we do them because we're scared.
But isn't the enormity of 9/11, doesn't it make it hard to kind of do that cost-benefit analysis? It was really bad, obviously, for the people who died and were injured, and for the economy, and in so many other ways. Isn't it kind of hard to overspend to stop something like that?
Yes, it's very, very hard. Doesn't mean it's right. Lots of things, right? Lots of things we do dumb that are hard not to do. Doesn't mean we should say, okay, we're going to do it, right? I mean, yes, it's hard. It's very hard. You know, speaking as the voice of rationality in the year after 9/11, nobody listened to you. Right? Here we are a dozen years later, and there's a lot more resonance to the exact same arguments. Nothing's changed, except people are now more receptive. So yes, it's going to be very, very hard. I mean, you know, just a basic statistic, more people die in car crashes every month than died in 9/11. Right? And 9/11's worth of deaths every single month the last 12 years. After 9/11, people were afraid to fly. They drove. The number of excess deaths because more people drove exceeded the deaths in 9/11. Right? It's completely irrational, even though it is perfectly understandable.
Well, let's look at some of the things we've found out recently that we're doing in our counterterrorism effort, in large part revealed by Edward Snowden, still on the run from the United States government. What did you make of what we learned from him about NSA and other surveillance here in the United States?
You know, so those of us who study security and surveillance, there was not a lot of surprises. You know, we assumed the NSA was breaking the law. We assumed the NSA was spying on Americans. We assumed this happened right after 9/11. And you know, we had a lot of anecdotal evidence. There were previous whistleblowers that didn't get this amount of press. What was surprising to me was a degree of legal contortionism that was going on to try to justify these things, that a justification would appear, and if it didn't work, another one would be tried. Sort of how much the NSA has gone rogue, eavesdropping on everybody and all things. So, I mean, and it's a surprise. And you see more and more revelations that they are demanding, you know, I just read this morning that they are demanding encryption keys from companies so they can break encrypted traffic, maybe people's passwords for their accounts. They have financial data. We've learned a few weeks ago that they are photographing mail, physical mail, front and back copies, front and back of envelopes to, again, keep records of who's communicating with who. We know about phone records, know about SMSs and emails, and other messages on various sites. It's U.S., it's Americans, it's foreigners. The amount of data is truly amazing. And on the one hand, it's kind of the same sort of stuff that Google does. Right? Google collects information about you and what you're interested in, what you're doing. The difference is the error. Right? When Google makes a mistake, they show you an ad for a Chevy you don't like. When the NSA or the FBI makes a mistake, they arrest you, or they drop a drone on your village. Right? So it's the same sorts of technologies, but the results are very different.
Well, but a lot, after 9/11, there were a lot of accusations that the NSA, FBI, CIA didn't do enough of this kind of stuff, and they didn't connect dots. There was the information out there. They could have maybe prevented this attack or had warning signs that they weren't able to act on. So maybe what they're doing now lets them connect those dots for the next, maybe not 9/11, but a lesser terrorist attack.
But see what you said. Could have, maybe, might have, maybe, possibly. I mean, this is the argument. And it's very – connecting the dots is a really bad metaphor. After the fact, it's easy to connect the dots, right? You see five of them, they're in a line. Why didn't you see them beforehand? Well, before then, there were 20 billion dots They resolved into thousands and tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of possible plots. They were all false alarms, except maybe this one. And it isn't a matter of dot connecting. I mean, a lot of those accusations are from people who don't understand intelligence analysis. I mean, we couldn't find two Boston bombers who were really chatty on Facebook. This is, connecting the dots is not the way you stop terrorism. It's through investigation. It's through following leads.
So,
and the kind of boring stuff you'll see on cop shows, right, going after the leads one after the other. Great example were the liquid bombers who were captured in their London flats before they even got to the airport. That was traditional investigative police work. It wasn't mass surveillance. It wasn't mass eavesdropping. It was following leads.
Do you think that our interest, our investment in mass surveillance is detracting from that kind of old-fashioned police-style work?
I think it is. I mean, and we're here seeing articles. I mean, we've heard about the military-industrial complex. We're hearing it called the surveillance-industrial complex. There's a lot of money riding on these big-ticket systems, right? These massive databases, these systems for analysis. And there's a lot of interest in keeping them going, both from the corporate side and from the government side, the NSA, the U.S. Cyber Command, that is consolidating power. So it's hard to have this debate. I mean, the amazing thing was the vote in Congress, in the House last week, to defund one program, just the program that eavesdrops on every American's phone calling data. And that vote, you know, didn't fall on traditional party lines. I mean, Obama, it was the Democratic and Republican leadership and Obama that prevented members on both sides, you know, tried to prevent that vote from happening. It's a really interesting vote. So, you know, we are seeing this debate. It was surprisingly close. So hopefully we are going to discuss these things.
Talking to security expert Bruce Schneier about our counterterrorism efforts, he says our perception of risk is out of whack and our response is way out of proportion sometimes to the threat that's out there.
And we want to know what you think. What do you think of the approach the United States has taken to preventing terrorist attacks? Is it too much? Has it gone too far? Or is it appropriate to the threat that is posed? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We continue our conversation now with security expert Bruce Schneier about the risk of terrorism and how we react to it. Interested in hearing from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are we doing too much? Are we on the right track? Give us a call. Bruce, before we get to the phones, I wanted to ask about another piece you wrote recently about mission creep, using the tools that we have to fight terrorism, maybe for more and more unrelated activities.
Well, I mean, this is something I worry about. A lot of these powers have been granted because of this perceived exceptional threat of terrorism. So terrorism is, in a sense, the root password to the Constitution. It's such a grave danger, the story goes, that we have to throw away the Fourth Amendment, throw away due process, allow for all these things. Well, now the question is, once these tools are in place, what happens next? Where the NSA is building this massive database, does it make sense to say, well, there's a kidnapping going on, and what will save the child is going to be the data in this database? Or a murder, and then after that, what can we use it to for immigration reform? Can we use it? Right now, there is at least one case I know of where a defendant says the data that will prove my innocence is in this NSA database. It was phone calls I made. Verizon no longer has that record. The NSA does. I'd like access to it. And the government is saying no. Right? You cannot use this data to prove your innocence. It's only for terrorism. Does that make any sense? Right? So once you start building these capabilities, I think it's a very easy ride before you use them for other things, before now we're under constant surveillance to catch speeders or whatever the mundane crime is. Because the data's there, we spent the money, let's recoup our investment. So I'm very worried about building a police state sort of from the back door. Now, we're not building it for a police state, we're building it for this one purpose, but it's very easy to start using it in other purposes.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Jerry on the line in Green Bay. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm from Ireland, and I grew up with the IRA terrorism in the late 70s, early 80s, through that whole issue. I think the point is that the terrorists are winning when we overreact to this point. The point is to have an overreaction and overspend money to make the war too costly for the opposition to be in the war.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, what terrorists want is to cause terror. And causing terror requires the complacency of all of us, of the media. If a bomb goes off and nobody reports it, there's no terror. There's no terrorism. And interesting, in Ireland, the news media decided amongst themselves that they were just not going to report these things. They were going to deny the IRA the megaphone, the ability to magnify their attacks. Terrorism is a weird crime because the victims aren't really the victim. The victims are a tactic in order to make the rest of us terrorized. And my motto is refuse to be terrorized. Because if we refuse to be terrorized, regardless of what they do, they lose.
But I can't see any way that the media in the United States wouldn't report on a bombing on American soil.
I mean, I agree. I mean, this is hard to do. But you can decide to report about it just once, not every day. I mean, the Boston bombings were, I mean, that just killed two people. It was three. I forget what the toll was. It was extraordinarily minor. It was much less than deaths in many other cities. Yet this was the headline story for weeks and weeks. You can decide not to report it. You might not like it because you're not going to get the ratings because this kind of stuff does sell advertising, but it also plays into the terrorists' hands.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jerry. We'll go now to Jerry in Menasha. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. The police state tactics are on the part of the 16 different alphabet agencies, NSA, FBI, CIA, who have gone way above and beyond their powers, are not necessary. Our threat of terrorism is due. The root cause is our foreign policy and our fooling around in other countries, supporting dictators over the years, supporting corporate interests over the interests of the people in these countries. And now, of course, we've invaded two different countries that did not attack us. And over the last decade, the government has terrified the American public consistently. We have this idea that, oh, we need security so desperately. Oh, make us secure. Well, the most secure people in the world are the ones that are in solitary confinement for 23 and a half hours a day. You're going to have democracy or you're going to have a police state. You have
gotcha.
A choice.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. So her main point there, I think, was the kind of the blowback theory of Chalmers Johnson that the terrorism we're facing is in part because of what we've done in foreign affairs. Is it that simple, do you think?
Nothing's ever that simple. I mean, I think the most compelling thing about that argument is the fact that it was made on the air, that right after 9/11, people who said that were shouted down to say that it is possible that U.S. foreign policy is a root cause was anathema. You couldn't say that, right? That meant you were excusing what the terrorists did, which is, of course, nonsense, but that's what the rhetoric does. Now, 12 years later, we can have a discussion about U.S. foreign policy and whether the things we do cause blowback. Certainly there's part of that. Right? Certainly things we've done in Iraq have caused the insurgency, which we're calling terrorism, in Iraq against American troops and civilians. I mean, that's sort of obvious. And yes, our foreign policy does make people hate us. I mean, we could decide it's worth it. Right? We can decide that, yes, our foreign policy is more important, and therefore we're going to live with the increased risk, but then we should live with the increased risk. But just having this conversation means we've gone so much further than we have a dozen years ago.
We'll go back to the phones now. Graydon is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Graydon.
Hi. I guess I'd like to make a comment too. Like, I've read, I'm an English major. I've read a lot of books about the dystopian futures that have been imagined up by many different people. And I guess there's some concern in me that we're creating something else, because we have programs like PRISM, and we have so much information data, people that these writers didn't really anticipate. So much more permeates our everyday lives that we don't perceive or understand. So we give so much power by giving over authority to, groups like the NSA. And I guess how does that change when we can't even see the tools that are watching us at all times?
Gotcha. Graydon, thanks for the call. These are invisible to us, he says, Bruce.
I mean, these are very interesting. And you read the dystopias, they took a lot of work. There's a lot of manpower. East Germany, you had 10% of the people spying 90%. It took an enormous amount of manpower. And you just didn't have the data. You had to get it manually. What's changed is that everything we do involves computers, and computers produce data. You go to an ATM machine, you make a phone call, you use a token in a toll booth. All of these things produce data, license plate capture, everything PRISM is getting. Well, financials now are now credit cards. So all of this data is being generated by us naturally. So you don't need someone watching you. All you need to do is to collect up the data. And it turns out that the NSA doesn't even have to collect it, that corporations are collecting it anyway. Right? Google is collecting it. Amazon's collecting it. Your phone company, your credit card company, data brokers. This data is being collected. It's being bought. It's being sold. It's being consolidated. All the NSA has to do is ask for a copy of it. Right? That's what that first Snowden document was. It was the government saying to Verizon, you already know who's calling who. We want a copy. And that just makes the surveillance state much easier, because it's already there. We're doing it. And we can't stop. You can't say, throw away your cell phone. Don't use a computer. Right? Never go in front of a surveillance camera. Live in the forest. Live in a cave. It's just not realistic. Don't use money. Don't use a bank. Right? We have to live our lives. Our lives involve computers, and data is being produced.
Bruce, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Bruce Schneier. He's a security expert, author of Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust Society Needs to Survive.
Coming up, a new survey says 4 out of 5 adults struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least parts of their lives. We'll take a look at the new face of poverty coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.